morning, everyone. So I'm Sue Zappel, and we have four of us this morning are going to share some of our experiences around ritual and devotional practices. I'll start, and then we're going to do about 6 minutes apiece, and then we'll have a short pause between them. So the things that have always drawn me to ritual and devotional practices are the sense of mystery and the sense of community. I grew up in a Jewish home. My father died when I was little. My mother wasn't religious, but my grandfather, my mother's father, lived with us until he died when I was about 12. He was Orthodox, and we called him Papa. And I would get up in the morning and I would watch Papa put on his tallis, the shawl, and the tefillin, which are these little boxes and straps. And he would pray going forward and back. And I didn't understand it, but it seemed wonderful to me. There was a look on his face. I don't know if I even have words to describe it. But it just was wonderful. Papa called me his Rebbetzin, his little rabbi. I was the youngest of all the cousins of all the grandkids, and I was the only one interested in anything to do with religion. I loved going to shul. I was the only one in my family who did. I went to shul and Sunday school and Hebrew school and rabbi study and the whole thing. And at the shul, I would just love when they opened up the ark and brought the Torah down. And I would watch as the rabbi would take a part of his tallis and kiss it, and then touch that part to the part of the Torah that he would be reading that day. None of this really had anything to do with God for me. It was just all this devotion of the people, the sound of the cantor's voice, the collective sound of the congregation, all of us singing the same songs. And of course, there were people who, you know, were just going through the motions or showing off their fine outfits on the high holidays. But for me, even as a really young person, I felt the collective devotion and the sense that we were all doing the same thing that people had been doing for centuries. There were stories that weren't believable, but people acted like they believed them. And it was all so mysterious and fascinating. And then community. So Passover was and continues to be my favorite holiday. Everyone, young and old, gathers to tell and retell the same story. The story is hugely mythic. I mean, really the parting of the Red Sea, and also very ritualistic. As the youngest, and of course the only one interested, I got to ask the four questions about why do we do these things on Passover that we don't do ordinarily. All of it was mysterious. None of it really made sense to me, but I loved it. And there was all the music and food. And then on Shabbos, we would light the candles and say the same prayer every single Friday night over the wine and the bread. Hanukkah, more candles, more songs and food, of course, and mystery. How did those containers of oil last 8 days? So when I stopped believing in God, I know I was 12 or 13, I never stopped believing in the amazing mystery of life. I don't really know how I translated those early experiences into my love for ritual, but there it is. We Jews have these little candles, they're about this big, they're called yahrzeit candles, and they burn for 24 hours. And I burn them on the anniversary of everyone who was dear to me, the anniversary of their death. I put a picture of the person and the candle in my kitchen, and then I talk to the person as I walk in and out of the kitchen all day. When I was first introduced into Buddhism, of course I loved the commonsensical ahipasiko, you know, look and come see for yourself part of it. But I also love the ritual of the refuges, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And it all drew me in. An element of mystery about seeing someone who was sick, someone who was old, someone who was dying, And that made the Buddha give up everything and go wander around trying to figure out what life was all about. Of course, the Dhamma is filled with truths, but there's so much mystery. And of course, the Sangha, the community. So when I go on retreat and I come into the meditation hall, as we were talking when we first joined this morning about Cloud Mountain, I bow every time to the Buddha and I recite the refuges. At home, I smudge my whole house before I go on an at-home retreat. I light candles, not just the yardside candles. I love the I Ching. I love the tarot, and I do a lot of tarot readings. In the garden that I go into every morning, I am amazed and awed by the determination of life. Every plant, whether the weeds we don't want or the cucumbers I'm cultivating, want to live and thrive. It's all kind of awesome and humbling and connecting. It's that love of life at every level of life. Last Monday, Carrie gave this amazing talk, and if you haven't heard it, you should listen to it. She talked about how devotion and ritual come from the part of our brain that's inclined towards the bigger things, less analytical, less linear, less conceptual. So ritual opens up for me those not knowing parts of life, and I honor them.
Man, I don't know how I go past that.
Oh, you're so sweet, Terry.
I actually want to talk about devotion more so than ritual. And I want to represent the Christian. It's kind of weird representing a faith when faith is like huge. Everybody has their different understanding, but I want to talk about it from the Christian perspective. At least I want to talk about it from the Black church Christian perspective, because I think that's a little different than the way the white perspective is. But so when I was a child, my parents, my father was Catholic, my mother was a Methodist, but they did not really go to church. They were constantly talking about God. So everything in our lives, at least with my mother, was referenced in some relation to God. So if we ate, we had to thank God. And there was always this understanding that anything that happened to us out of the grace of God. And so, but church, going to church was not really their thing. They used to just send us to go find a church. They were staying at home in the bed, chilling out. I think it was like their daycare or something. But then my mother found a church that she loved. Somehow she stumbled upon this church. It's a big church in Seattle, for a big Black church. And I went with her one Sunday. And that was a game changer. I must have been about 12 years old. The music was unbelievable. And I would be transported from all the stuff that was going on in my house, which was, you know, pretty chaotic and crazy. And yet, when we would walk into church, the world would change. That the music and the choir, in a Black church, the choir, it's not just some group of people over on the sideline that sing or that lead the congregational music. The choir is almost as integral as the pastor is and the sermon. And the offering, the taking of offering, is also as integral as there are these little pieces that in a Black church there has to be. And I want to tell you the four of them, four pieces that sort of make up that experience: the choir, the sermon, the offering, and there's one more piece, which is called, it's usually called oh my God, it just slipped me. It's a prayer that happens at the end of a sermon. And there's a prayer and an opportunity to come into the church if you want to. So altar prayer is what it's called. Those four little pieces in a Black church has so much significance because they set a framing that it's almost like they create a barrier between you and the rest of the world. And so I would go and get caught up in the music. You're singing. I mean, the way we sing to God and about being, you know, Christian or whatever, it's invincible. That's what the music is. It's almost like the louder you get, we were loud. We could sing as free as we wanted to. The music was so upbeat that we could, even the songs that were sad were so upbeat, so energized. And so that music would transport you. The sermons were all about how powerful God was against the backdrop of everything. It didn't matter what your problem was. God was more powerful than that. And then finally, this taking of offering was almost like this ritualistic way in which we all realized that our church was not going to survive unless we all participated in it. So there was a sense of everybody's helping to make sure the church stays upright. The altar prayer, and this is the last piece I want to mention. The altar prayer was more about your own personal letting go. So these altar prayers, not every Black church has a huge altar prayer, but many of them do. It's like this minister starts talking about how hard life is and what God can offer. And you individually, so you've already been transported from the choir and everything into this world. So you individually begin to think about your own life and all the things that are pulling at you, and you're afraid. You don't think you can make it. You don't think you can handle this. I don't think I can do it. And this minister would pull you into the altar, basically, is what it would feel like. So some people would literally get up out of their seats and go to the altar and get on their knees in front of it. But many people just sat right there in their seat and didn't go. But you'd have this huge influx of people coming into this altar. And when you get to the altar, there would be this opportunity, sort of like the minister would be over the top. I always equate it to our meditations. It's sort of like there's a guided meditation over the top, but we are somehow having a personal conversation or a personal connection with awareness on our own. And all of us are having this personal awareness with this kind of overarching timekeeper that's keeping the time, basically. It doesn't have to be words, but we're all connected in that way. And that's what I think the practice was. That's what connected us all together. So when I think of Dhamma, that's what I brought with me. I brought with me this sense of I needed energy to move me, and I needed to know that the Dhamma would be more powerful than anything I had to deal with, and this sense of wanting to pay into or contribute to something that I knew I needed to come to. And when we meditate, it sort of, or the Dhamma talks kind of bring us all in together so that I don't feel like I'm by myself. And I think the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, it was just so resonant with all of that, that making the shift from practicing in the church and practicing in Dhamma was not difficult for me at all. Thank you.
My name's Arv. I'll go next. I grew up in a Hindu family. There was a lot of importance given to meditation and self-inquiry, particularly the question, who am I? This was an object of study for us. But there was also a lot of ritual. I grew up in Houston, and, on special occasions, we'd drive an hour to this temple, and it was something I didn't look forward to. It was just going to be sitting in a car and then, going around to all these statues and, doing your prayers. And some of that I really liked. I really liked the sort of standing and concentrating bits, but there are parts I wasn't crazy about. Every summer we would go to India and I would stay there for 2 or 3 months with my grandparents. There's a lot of ritual practice in those visits. My mother's father to this day begins every day with meditation and chanting. And, we'd all go and we'd sit with him. And I loved that. These days he tends to nod off a little. He's about 100. But he still does it. He gets up and he does it. We'd visit the ashrams of gurus and spiritual leaders when we were there. This is probably both my favorite thing and also a very, very memorable experience of my childhood. There was one guru that my family was, would follow, and he had an ashram in the jungle in Kerala, and we would go there, and it felt a little bit like a meditation retreat does. Every morning we'd wake up early, we'd begin the day with a meditation. There would be sort of a very, a very pure vegetarian meal without a lot of sharp flavors. There are very controlled elements that, you weren't allowed to have onions or garlic or spices. And you'd spend the day in contemplation. There would be these evening Dharma talks. And I remember sitting and you'd ask the guru questions. He would give you answers. But perhaps most memorable of all of these rituals were weekly bhajans. Bhajans are these, these events where you're all sitting together in a room and you're singing. And it's in this call and response form. So if it's my turn to give the bhajan, you go in order. Everyone's sitting, everyone gets a turn. If it's your turn, you come up with the song and you sing out the phrase, and then everyone sings the same phrase back to you. They respond and it echoes what you said in the group. It's a very powerful feeling. And it's a very connected feeling. I would, people would tell stories of bhajans they'd attended where it would spontaneously start raining jasmine petals, because they were calling divinity into the room. We're singing each other into the light. We're bringing that into the room, and this would happen. I spent a lot of time thinking about whether that really did happen or not. But that was a very memorable experience. And, you had to sit on this hard floor for like an hour and a half. And, I was 9 years old, and that was a hard part of these bhajans. I had to look forward to sitting, no cushion. I always fall backwards if I'm sitting cross-legged. So I was struggling not to fall backward the whole time. But at the same time, yeah, you're doing the singing and it's magical. So in all of this, so there's the self-inquiry side I mentioned, there are all these rituals. There is a certain puzzle in all of this to me. And, on the one hand, you'll hear how important all of these specific rituals are. Priests will tell you in earnest tones how reciting a certain mantra 108 times every morning was critical. And then on the other hand, you'll hear these gurus kind of taking you aside and going like, it doesn't really matter if you do that specific thing or not. And they're giving you this message that, there are a whole lot of paths to enlightenment, whatever that means, connecting to universal consciousness or to God. And, Hindus tend to think of other religions as being, kind of Hindu, like growing up in Texas, you had to keep this a secret. You didn't want to tell the Christians next door that they were actually Hindu. But that's kind of how we all felt. Like, these are all paths to God. It doesn't really matter which one you take. You just have to approach them with the right intentions and with a pure heart. That was the idea. And so there is kind of a conflict in my mind. Do this specific set of things, these rituals, and also it doesn't matter on the other side. And the way I resolved this in my mind was that, as a kid, the way I resolved it was, there's one Hinduism for people who don't want to think about it. And that's, you know, you chant the mantra 108 times, you worship Ganesha on his birthday for good luck, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's another Hinduism for people who really want to take seriously this inquiry into the nature of the universe, nature of the self. And for that group, yeah, maybe you did the rituals, but it was kind of with a nod and a wink. You know, you understood that they were arbitrary and they were physical acts intended to connect you with a certain state of mind, with a certain set of beliefs or intentions. And, you know, I definitely wanted to be in that latter group. You know, like, yeah, I wasn't going to be a chump, you know, I wanted to continue to do some of the rituals and I continued to connect with them. But I felt a little smug about it all. You know, I preferred to focus on the meditation. And I was like, yeah, I know I do these things, but, you know, they're arbitrary. So, you know, looking back on that, there's been this journey for me from there to this, to Buddhism and my current meditation practices. And you know, I think back and I think if I had recognized that my meditation itself, the thing I took most seriously as a teenager, if I recognized that that was a ritual, you know, this sitting cross-legged in a sacred space, spine erect, silent, I might have gained both some humility and also a deeper understanding of the value of ritual. You know, and today I can't even conceive of spiritual practice without ritual. You know, maybe the only way I can is if, you know, I were walking around enlightened all the time, always in touch with the moment and, you know, expanded sense of consciousness as I was eating cereal and shopping for groceries. But outside of that, you know, I need ritual. It's this meditation. It's this sitting. It's being together in this group here that really moves me forward, that really reminds me of what's important. And there's also this thing that Sue's mentioned, and that Susan alluded to in her meditation when she asked us not to put so much effort into thinking. It's that I'm coming to realize how ritual and devotion connect us to a whole other path of discovery from the cerebral self-inquiry that, you know, I felt was really the most important thing as a kid. You know, it's not this, you know, cerebral way of inquiring into experience, but tapping into a felt sense of mystery, an expanded consciousness without really thinking about it. I'm still kind of going into that and exploring that, but that's where I am now. Yeah.
That was really great. Thanks, Arv. Hi, my name is Dane. I recently joined the LDLs as a practice leader, and I'm really excited to be able to participate and learn from everyone around me. I wanted to start off by saying how grateful I am to be able to share with this community that's so opening and welcoming. There's something truly special about the way everyone here listens and helps to hold this space. I grew up in a household with basically no religious orientation at all. It wasn't even truly atheist. We just didn't talk about things like that. The most I heard was my grandma was in one of the weird religions that didn't make sense and should be avoided. Growing up, my main exposure to religion was what we see in the news, from the mildly positive to the truly hateful. And from that point of view, it just made sense to be atheist. Why participate in a system that seemed to have so little potential for good with these incredible downsides? My journey into seeing sacredness more clearly came slowly, inch by inch, and it's been beautiful to watch unfold. I wasn't able to notice these moments for a large portion of my life. I considered myself depressed and thought maybe things like that just didn't happen for my brain. And then when Tiwari brought up Sambhaga the other day, it deeply resonated with me and gave me a better explanation for what was going on in my life, particularly the part of the description that reads, the oppressive sense of shock, dismay, and alienation that come with realizing the futility of life as it's normally lived. Having a term to describe what we've been through is incredibly powerful, can lend strength and provide a path out. One of the things that is particularly sinister about depression, we all know it can rob energy and joy from your life, is that it takes away your hope that things can be different, the hope that the way you experience the world might change. But when I started to truly listen through meditation, I found these moments of sacredness coming up more and more often in my life, ranging from the large and expansive to these tiny, simple, ordinary moments. And sacredness to me means a connection to something greater than myself, an underlying sense of love that everything is a part of. The first time I remember this happening in my life, I think I was around 25 and being out in the mountains rock climbing, and I didn't even really know what it was at the time. The sense of being so small in this world and awe at the majestic beauty that surrounded me, and the deep sense of stillness and quiet that the trees and rocks carry. One of the truly beautiful things about that experience is its universality. We don't need a deep meditation or spiritual practice for it to be available to us. We just have to be in the right place. And I remember a moment this winter sitting in a hospital waiting room with my broken arm, and everything seemed to shift just so slightly. A deep sense of stillness came up within the commotion and people walking around and sitting and waiting on their phones. And metta just started pouring out of me towards everyone around me in the room, in the space. And it was really beautiful to be a part of. And it even comes up in really simple moments, just listening to a friend where the sense of self seems to drop away a bit and the need to respond is no longer there, or truly being heard by someone when you're speaking. And we can't force these moments to come up, but I think we can incline or orient towards them. There's a sutta the Buddha talks about awakening and gives these three examples of a stick of coming to, like, how awakening can happen. And one, he says, trying to light a stick on fire that's wet and full of sap sitting in the water, and that'd be pretty much impossible. And the next example is a stick that's wet and full of sap near the water, which would also be really tough. And then the third is a stick that's dry and there's no sap in it and it's far away from the water, and that'd be easier to light on fire. And in the same way, I think we can put ourselves in the right situation to experience these moments of sacredness more often. And for me, that's having an ongoing meditation practice, bringing the Dharma into my life, and learning to be with these moments when they do come up, seeing them clearly and not trying to cling to them. And then as for ritual, I've always had a strong resistance in my life to ritual. When I was younger, I don't think there was a better way to convince me not to do something than to tell me this is the way it was always done. This started to build a pattern in my life where I lumped anything like this into one big box that I just called nonsense. Oh, they said I need to do it because it's tradition. Let's just put it in the nonsense box and forget about it. And this makes a lot of sense. Our minds are developed to survive this hostile world by lumping things into patterns and categories so we don't have to think too hard about them. As well as just our world's really complex. And if we had to think about everything that came up, it'd be a lot of work to get through every day. But this also can work against us in things like this. And it's worked against me, making it difficult to see when I've mislabeled something that might be potentially useful and thrown it into that nonsense box without trying it out and seeing what's really there. And I've been drawn to the phrase lately, what's in the way is the way, as my meditative journey has deepened. And I'm really excited to explore ritual a little more deeply and see this aversion more clearly and see what it might open up in my life going forward. Thank you all.
Oh, thank you all so much. And welcome, welcome, Dane Foy. I'm so touched by all of your shares. And now is the time for you to share. So we have an opportunity, and we didn't quite talk about who was going to do this. So I just am jumping in here. So anybody of the LDLs who shared, please take over if you'd like. We have an opportunity now to get into small groups and talk about how we're holding a ritual and taking these beautiful shares into our hearts and how we're reflecting on all of it. So we always have an opportunity for you to leave, though, if you need to. So if you'd like to say goodbye, and a lot of people are saying that in the chat, and leave, we ask, you can do that now. But we want you to stay, because discussion is one of the ways. I love the what Dane said about what's standing in our way is the way. These discussions are a great way to see ourselves, to listen, and then to also see what comes up when we're listening to others and how we're speaking. So I encourage you to stay. But if you must leave, please do now and come back next Sunday. So would any of the LDLs care? I just made a reflection on, just reflecting on what the talks, how the talks landed for you and what's resonating for you in your own life and history. Does that sound good as a reflection? Okay. All right. So I'm going to.
Oh, you're going to create the rooms? Good.
I'll go ahead and create the rooms. You'll have, I believe, 20 minutes. Let's see. Yeah, you'll have 20 minutes.
Please. A little bit less, maybe.
Okay. Let's just do 15 and then I might. Okay. 15 minutes, because then we'll come back for a Q&A. So now you can raise your hand, your real hand, or your the cartoon hand, which I can't actually locate. So I usually just wave frantically. I will see you, or one of the other LDLs will see you. Feel free to ask any question that you'd like, or offer a reflection. You can direct a question to someone specific, or comment. Whatever you'd like. I want to know what happened in those rooms. So you can also say, well, in our room, we talked about, you don't have to name anyone.
So I wanted to say something as a way of also encouraging people to come back next Sunday, because two of the people in my group brought up something that's so powerful about looking to ritual and different practices as a way of kind of like fixing ourselves and understanding how it's what's inside. And one of them said to realize that you don't need fixing after all. And Tiwari next week is going to be talking about some of the dangers or risks involved around ritual. And I think one of them is this piece of, you know, what kind of importance we put on that. So I just wanted to encourage people to come back. And to where he had to leave early today for a family thing.
I'll go ahead and share something. I really thank you so much. I really appreciated hearing from everyone. And so I'm a preacher's kid and grew up in the Episcopal Church, which was, in a really small town also. And I just wanted to say something about community. So when I first started coming to Sims, I felt like, it was just really difficult to establish community. I felt like there was such an emphasis on being quiet before and being quiet after. And, since Sims made the shift to Sunday morning in particular, I felt like that was a really great place with the kids and reading the stories. But I feel like Sims has also made more of an effort to have it be okay for us to talk to each other a little bit more. And then that has helped me. And then I hate to say it, but with coming here online, I have felt closer and more of a sense of community because I've been able to come to more things also online. And that's, I think the church instilled that importance of community as part of my ritual. And I've appreciated Sims shifting to allowing more opportunities for us to build community and to be a little bit looser so we can have conversations more and stuff. So I've really appreciated that shift because I realize that's an important part of my ritual is being able to connect with people. So thank you.
Brooke, that was one of the main motivations for those of us who started the Sundays, is that not to deny or not to dishonor the quiet and the stillness, which we all also appreciate, but that opportunity to connect with each other. And so we wanted to offer an option for people. Yeah, thank you for what you said. Unmute yourself.
Rosalie? Rosie.
I agree with what everybody said, but it was so precious having children and families, and I hope some way that will return, because that was the original part of the original intent of Sims, was to be sure that Carol Guile and I, anyway, I think that's so important that families be involved, especially children.
And we're having a meeting tomorrow, actually, just to discuss that very point.
See what we can do.